you're saying.
We were affected by that internal debate back here in the States. In the, from our standpoint, a very repulsive sort of way. We knew that the argument was going on. We knew that our marching orders were to not be salesmen, not encourage the Iranians to buy more, expand faster, or anything of that sort, but to assist them as they made their own decisions. And this sounds a little pious, but doggone it, we believed it, and we had beaten our friends. We were encouraged to take the viewpoint that if they're going to buy it anyway, it's better from our viewpoint that it be American. In other words, they are going to buy. We'd rather they buy from us than the French or the British or the Italians or the Germans or even the Saudis. But we were not salesmen. We were not pushing things.
Right.
When the Iranians asked to buy something, we had to send a message back for what we call a P&A, price and availability.
Right.
We would send the message back, and basically it would say, the Iranians are interested in buying so-and-so. Please give us some guidance with respect to an estimated price, and when can the U.S. make it available, so that we can carry on a logical discussion with them. Almost every request we sent back, we just knew it was going through the hopper and going to be thrashed around. And there would be a large element, particularly in the State Department, but to some extent also in the military, both the service and the Secretary of Defense. There was going to be that group that was dedicated to, quote, delay. We used to say that there are very, very, very few people who can say yes. There are a few who can say no. Maybe a few more than there are that can say yes. But there are a zillion who can say wait. And sometimes it took a very inordinate amount of time to get an answer to a very simple question.
Now, was this before May 72 or after May 72, or just throughout the period?
Throughout the period. You answered my question. Throughout the period, the argument was always there, quite frequently, when we had visitors coming in from the States. I would start off my discussion by saying, now, which side of the debate are you on? Which view do you take? Almost like saying, are you Republican or Democrat? Because I knew if he was from the Department of State, he was going to be on one side or the other. Well, I'm going to be in the middle. He was going to say, I'm supporting or I'm delaying. Now, there was almost a sacrosanct statement that we will not say no to the Shah, particularly after Nixon's visit, because Nixon told him yes. We will not say no to the Shah, but we will say wait to anybody that's trying to represent the Shah. And that's the type of water we were swimming in.
They're interpreting Nixon's orders.
They were just being obstinate. It was just unpleasant, quite frequent.
So there were some in state, though, who wanted to, I saw a letter by Jack Miklos, who was a desk officer of state, said we have the Shah's, we have marching orders from Nixon and Kissinger to give the Shah where he wants.
I might have drafted that message. I came back.
Yeah.
It finally got so...
You mentioned that, about you went back for a meeting.
For a meeting, I had to just come back and say, look, I can quote, I think, reasonably close to verbatim, the president and the Shah. Now, if you have a debate with that, let's bring it out in the open. If not, please don't constantly hit me on the shins while I'm trying to run a race.
Now, in May 72, as you stated, Nixon and Kissinger told the Shah they got pretty much what he wanted, short of nuclear weapons.
Short of nuclear, yes.
Now, before that, what kind of restrictions govern Iran's assets to America?
Nixon was, to my mind, President Nixon was repeating or supporting a position that had already been taken.
Some practices are very
from my standpoint, I already had the same working orders. There was always a question when you got into one of the very intricate intelligence electronics high level deal. There's always little questions of that sort. But basically, the overall view was if they want it and they are willing to pay for it, they may have it.
Now, you've touched upon this issue a little bit, but maybe you expand upon it. Now, what was the MAG's relationship with the corporations that actually sold, that produced and sold the weapons, the weapon systems that Iran would be purchasing for this period?
Our relationship in every instance was one of evolution. When it first came up, if there was more than one U.S. producer, we couldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. We could not be involved when a producer, commercial producer, I should say, and the Iranian were discussing the subject. Now, many of the commercial people came over and said, I have this proposition. I have this that I would like to discuss. And I, or some of my people, personally arranged to identify the Iranian that would be the contact guy. We arranged the meetings, scheduled them, but we didn't go. Quite frequently, commercial people came over, came into my office, set up their charts, and reviewed their presentations with us. And we listened. Quite frequently said they won't understand if you present it that way. I suggest you make us work together and make you another chart. And we found draft one, made charts for them. So we supported the commercial people quite a bit. But when they were contacting the Iranians, we were not present. If an Iranian asked me about a commercial presentation, all I could do was to get some information. I'd get him as much information as I could. I would explain the information. I would do everything I could to ensure that he understood the information. But I could never, and I never did, say, I think you ought to buy this one as opposed to that one. Because this one was produced by one company, that one's produced by another company. I couldn't get into that.
Now, you mentioned that you gave them some support, like technical assistance.
Oh, yes.
What other kinds of things did you, did MAG do? That would help expedite the efforts by the companies to get to the Iranian market, I guess.
Well, quite frequently, John Tufani would say, look, somebody came in here from Northrop and they said they could do this, that, and the other, and also something. And I'd look at his list there and say, yeah, they said they could furnish this, and they could furnish that, and furnish something, and a price list. And I'd say, yes, but look, I don't see any spare parts. It's habitual when you buy a piece of military equipment to buy the item plus 1 year's worth of spare parts, estimated use of spare parts. I said, yes, that item looks relatively cheap there, but there are no spare parts. I don't see any list for the technical manuals. I don't see any list for the technical training that will be required before that can be put in use. In other words, I tried to help them ensure that the presentation from the commercial field was complete and understood. But I could not ever say, this is one type airplane. I think you ought to buy this instead of this one. I need to be involved in that.
Right, right. And you said you met with a number of the representatives from the companies from time to time. Who were some of, can you recall some of the individuals that you met with? People that were more frequent visitors, I suppose, or
I guess the one that came over most often was Frank Sylvester, Vice President of Bell Helicopter Company. Jim Atkins, the President of Bell, came over. There would be many other people from Bell. Now, as far as Teledyne Ryan, Barry Shillitoe was the president of Teledyne Ryan. He came over.
Shillitoe
yeah. Used to be Assistant Secretary of Defense before he retired from that. Went out. He just retired from Teledyne now. But Barry came over several times.
Tom Jones of Northrop?
Tom Jones, I saw him several times. Glenn Lord came over from the same company.
What about Kermit Roosevelt?
Kermit Roosevelt came over several times, but there was a real rough go there. And then Kermit had been very active in the CIA activities previously.
At 53, yeah.
And a lot of people felt beholden to Kermit. They appreciated what he'd done for them and all that. But then Kermit, in their minds, and this is, I'm telling you, all from one side, so this is a one-sided story entirely, that might be wrong. The Iranians got the impression that Kermit Roosevelt was trying to capitalize on his friendship. So he went, when he went to the Hawk missile approach, they weren't happy with that at all. In fact, they were just against him. Kermit did more harm than did good. They didn't want him over there at all, because it felt like he was just saying, now, I helped you a long time ago, and I think I ought to have a little commission on this activity.
He was trying to sell the Northrop Hawk missile? That
yes. Yeah. Yes, he was on the so-called improved Hawk. And when they finally signed the contract on that thing, one of my very specific instructions was to, what we call, wire brush it good and carefully, and ensure that the contract did not include any commission for him as an individual.
For Roosevelt?
No. So, things like that got kind of stuck together now and then. There was a Captain Pollard, retired Navy Captain Pollard.
He was with the embassy in the 50s too, I think.
Yes, he was.
Made a lot of shit.
And he represented Grumman, I believe it was. I'm not really sure, and I believe it was Grumman. But he got quite pushy, and they got outdone with him. Most of them came over, at least they gave the air of being low-key, gave the air of, I want to help you, gave the air of, I have a capability to help you if you need me, holler. Some of them came over and really took on the attitude of, you don't have a choice but to deal with me, and I'll and the Iranians didn't appreciate it. So it ran the complete spectrum. My son was pretty good. Most of them.
Great.
A few clinkers in there.
Yeah. Now later on, during the mid-70s, it became known that Grumman had agreed to very large payoffs in order to expedite the sale of the F-14 Tomcat fighter jet. And were there any hints while you were in and around that they were up to something in this regard?
A little stronger than a hint.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of the name. There were two Iranian brothers who were very prominent in that field, and they were constantly trying to pull an in run and get Grumman in ahead of the pack. They pushed, Grumman from this side pushed very hard on the Navy Department here. We, as you may know, at that time were developing two advanced state-of-the-art aircraft.
Right.
One was the F-14, one was the F-15. The Navy was 14, the Air Force was 15. Those two aircraft were being developed along absolutely divergent views. I'll try not to make this too long. The 14 was a very, very sophisticated, advanced, state-of-the-art, the best that could possibly be produced for that purpose. It was a Navy project designed principally to work off aircraft carriers, and this is a very key part for designed to operate in clean air. By clean air, I mean the fleet takes to the high seas, and in effect it says anybody that comes within challenging range of me, I'm going to shoot him out of the sky. So the fleet, usually centered on a large aircraft carrier, steams out into the ocean, and it says in effect, don't tread on me, don't mess around, don't come close. If you come close enough to be a threat to me, that's a hostile move. Now, I'm talking about wartime, of course. So, the F-14 was designed with a very advanced, what is called Aug-9 radar that would reach out, way, way out. It would pick up a target and identify it up to 80 miles out, or sometime a little more. And then it had a missile on that plane that would engage that target 50 miles out. So it was a real mean bearcat. There was one. The two-place plane, two pilot and ordnance man. But it was designed to take off from an aircraft carrier and just clean the air out around the fleet and say, nobody comes close to this damn fleet. Now, the Air Force was told to develop a highly sophisticated, maneuverable airplane that could go in and tangle with anybody for a point defense, basically. In other words, defending airfields. That's what I saw. Airfields don't move. They're right there. So they would poop up and fight them in much closer than the F-14 was. But the F-15 was a more agile one-place plane, one pilot. It was much more agile. It didn't have near the range of its weaponry. So there were two completely different type airplanes. And then when the Iranians started thinking in terms of, gosh, those things sure look good in the prospectus, we'd like some of that. Well, we weren't ready to sell them at all. We had to develop them. We were in the process of developing and testing and what have you. But we weren't ready to even come close to a price on availability, and we just weren't ready to sell them. But the Iranians pushed so hard that our government made an agreement. We agreed that we would give parallel briefings on the development of the two aircraft. And we give them a briefing about every 4 to 6 months.
This is while you were there?
Oh, yeah. And that the briefing team would come from the United States, present its pitch, and go back. We weren't in the sales business at all. Well, the first briefing team came over, and they came in my office, and they set up their stuff, and we rehearsed it and modified their briefing just a little bit, pure and simple, to put it so that it'd be more understandable to the Iranian. And then the team was set up so that, and this was one of the very, very few times that a group went in with the Shah. The Shah was there, had his top military commanders there, and they gave a very good briefing. Everybody was happy. On the second or third one, I'm not sure which it was, the team came over and we went up to the palace and gave the briefing. And much, we had had a rehearsal too, but much to the great surprise of everybody, every American in the group, the Navy Admiral reached over and pulled out a little model of the F-14. Your Majesty, this is the Navy Tomcat. It is developed, it is ready, and we are ready to do business. And he presented that thing to them. I thought the Navy man, the Air Force man, was going to blow a gut clap. Well, we came out of that just absolutely livid. And the Navy just figured, by God, they were going to get ahead. They were going to make that sail, and the Iranians were going to buy their aircraft. So I, the Air Force man was just a little bit nervous, insisted that I send a message, which I did. I sent a message back. I told the Secretary of Defense that from our viewpoint, that I had a major breach of faith, and that the Air Force had the Navy had overstepped their bounds. And I said, I have nothing to do with it except the report. That's what it is. Well, the next time they came over Fort Waving, the same animal was sent back. And the presentation was going along, and the animal had a little film, had a 10-minute film to show. And he started showing the film, and both the Shah and General Cotton said, "Oh, we've already seen that." Well, that really blew it. So the Navy Admiral was retired right quickly. The Drummond people were in trouble, and we just had an awful mess on that. Drummond pushed too hard. Drummond got the idea that they weren't going to be team players. So we did have a very hard time with Drummond on that. But the Shah asked me which to buy, and I told him that was not my business. I couldn't tell him to buy one or the other. But I would like to discuss the characteristics of each. And I told him that the Air Force plane was designed as a point of defense, basically point of defense, small, relatively small area of defense, one position and all that, which is very agile, very good airplane, could do a lot of things for him. I said, the Navy plane has a lot of good attributes too. I said, as far as the state of your training at this time, the culture of your people, I said, I think your people would probably work better in pairs than as individuals. So I think that is a very good plus. I said, but you have one real danger. I said, if you use the F-14, you get into one of these, what we call neighborhood fights, and you start reaching out and shooting at something 50 miles away, I said, the chances, I'm afraid, I would be very fearful that you would shoot down a commercial passenger plane passing over just across the Afghanistan border, Pakistan border, or something like that. And I said, I just have real heartburn when I think of what would happen if you start launching a bunch of planes with the capability of the F-14. I said, you need to consider all that. Well, the decision as to what to buy was made after I left. He decided to buy Salt Beach. But that gives you an idea of how the commercial competition, and this wasn't very often, but sometime it just plain got out of hand.
Now, since each service was pushing its own fighter, there's inter-service rivalries also, besides the commercial rivalries, right?
Sure.
How does this affect the work of the MAG? Does this affect, have an internal effect within the MAG at all, or was it more of a Washington thing?
A little bit. We all came from our source. I was an Army officer charged with being a purple suit, as we call the joint people. And I was trying my best to be impartial. And in that case, it was relatively easy because it was the other two services. But I had no personal vested interest at all, and I was trying to be even handed. We did have some Air Force Army competition with respect to any aircraft targets and things of that sort, but not many. as a rule, we got along extremely well together. Not what you call animosity developed because of our backgrounds.
Now, how does Shaw explain to you his interest in these kinds of advanced fighter jets? For example, I read somewhere that when he met with Nixon in May 72, he talked about his concerns about Soviet MiGs that were flying over Iran near the border there. Did he ever discuss these kinds of concerns with? Is that a fact that he was concerned about that, or if he didn't, did he discuss this kind of issue with you?
Yes, he did mention the flights, and I think a good many of them were in fact confirmed.
Were what?
Confirmed. I don't think it was imagination on his part. They were there. Sometimes they cut short when they were going down to the Middle East, on the other side of the Gulf.
How serious a problem do you think that was?
I don't think it bothered him.
I
really don't. He always thought of the Russians. I think I've already mentioned to you, he didn't trust the Russians at all. Historically, Iran is not friendly with Russians. They don't like Russians at all. But I don't think that concerned him too much.
Did he say anything else about why he thought he needed these fighter jets? Whether the F-14 or the F-15?
I think I mentioned previously that the Shah had an obsession with two things, the best and the now. He wanted the very best of anything that came along. But to give you the other side of the picture, he had made the comment that he was just interested in the advanced state of the art, anything, whether it was medicine, agriculture, what have you, just had an insatiable desire for increased knowledge, or just tickled to death to learn something new. And he made a remark one time to me that anything unusual, anything really advanced state of the art comes along, I'd be interested. Well, we had some of our F-111s coming over to Europe, and I don't think I initiated this, but I did get in on the early stage. Someone thought, well, it'd be a good training flight for our people to whip down there. Asked the Shah if he'd be interested in seeing them. So I asked him, he said, yeah, I'd love to see one. So I don't know where they came from, but it was England or somewhere, a fair distance away. And that's the, I guess you'd call it the intruder type airplane that flies really on automatic control right from the word go. The pilots just sort of go along as passengers to abort the mission as much as anything else. They turn those things on, they go 80 miles an hour down right on the deck, under the radar screens, the purpose of it. But two of them came flitting in there one time, sat on the runway there for 3 days, I think. The Shah informed me when he was going out, asked if I'd like to join. Of course I did. And he walked around with that, he got in the cockpit. And incidentally, he was a very accomplished pilot himself. He wasn't just one of the guys that sat in the seat. He did all the gadgets and knew what he was doing with them. So he was very interested in it, and he talked to the pilots and said, you know, and after he finished, he pulled me off to one side and said, you know, why was he sent down here? I said, don't you recall a few months ago you mentioned that you were interested in seeing things that were new? He said, yes, I recall that conversation quite well, but why were they sent down? I said, for two reasons. One is the training flight is beneficial to our pilots and the people that are controlling the pilots. And two, we thought you were interested in just seeing it. He said, then you're not suggesting that I buy any? I said, no way in the world. I see no reason in the world to even read a thing of this sort. He said, okay, just go and make sure we're thinking together. Drop it.
Now, in terms of back to the F-14 for a little bit, more, I've read that some Pentagon officials oppose sale of advanced aircraft like those because they're fearful, or they worried rather that if Iran had them, this might compromise U.S. security in some way. Were you familiar with those arguments at that time?
I'm repeating myself an hour ago.
Yeah.
There was a large group here in Washington that was against sales of anything to Iran.
Because of the security issue?
They just, yeah.
No.
They just felt that Iran was becoming too strong.
Okay.
They felt the balance was coming out of line. So they were dedicated to, as a minimum, slowing the development in Iran. So we always knew that anything that came up was going to be opposed by some. But I did not get into the negotiation of the purchase. It was still in the development stage when I left.
Okay. Now, when Nixon and Kissinger visited Tehran in 72, did you discuss with them the F-14 or F-15 issues?
I don't believe so. Don't recall that subject.
I guess also around the same time, the Shah expressed an interest in buying laser-guided bombs.
Yes.
Did you discuss this issue with you?
I discussed it with the Iranians. Uh-huh. I did not discuss it with the President or next Kissinger.
With the Shah?
You talk about it? Yes, I discussed it with the President.
Did you make any sort of implicit reference? What did you think of that?
We just talked about the capabilities
of
it. The support of them, the use of them.
Uh-huh.
As you know, you do get the job done with considerably less number of bombs, less number of missions flown, less equipment and stuff, but you do need more backup support and more sophisticated in the training and things of that sort. So we just discussed the requirements and things of that sort.
I mentioned a minute ago that some people in the Pentagon, from what I've read, were concerned about the sale of these advanced systems, partly because of, I guess some made the argument that they might endanger U.S. security if these were held by Iran, they were lost to somebody else that was, fugitively unfriendly. Were these concerns discussed in the MAG?
Yes.
Yeah.
But the concerns that you're talking about didn't center on that.
Uh-huh.
As much as two other subjects.
Okay.
The concerns that were most often discussed were the intelligence pods, the ability to monitor the enemy. We had some very sophisticated equipment in that field. Often pods that fitted on airplanes and were flown along the border and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a real concern in the intelligence community that our most advanced, state-of-the-art things of that sort should not be outside U.S. control.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some people, and I was a little bit sympathetic with them. I think their concerns were somewhat legitimate. They just didn't want that equipment to fall in the hands of anybody that might mistreat them, whether it was Iranian or whether it was Iranian control and then inadvertently or intentionally given to somebody else. They just didn't want those things to get out.
I see.
Now, there was one other type equipment that gave us real heartburn, real concern. And that was the handheld anti-aircraft. Those things in the hands of terrorists would have been just atrocious. So those two fields were even more legitimate complaints than the so-called smart bomb. The smart bombs didn't give us a real hard time. We felt we could manage that all right.
Now, a little while ago you mentioned, you're talking about that you mentioned the MAG wire brushed, I guess, contracts to make sure that there weren't commissions involved or payoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was the general policy towards by MAG or the Defense Department generally towards commissions or payoffs to Iranian expediters? Did you have?
It wasn't just Iranian expediters.
Yeah, yeah, or American expediters.
When the Shah had his October 71 big party and his debutante ball, as I call it, coming out party, he said, "We have taken our rightful position in the community of advanced nations." He felt that very strongly. We are now talking with advanced nations on a co-equal basis. And as part of his thesis, we don't have to pay anybody a tax to get through the door. We don't have to pay for permission to talk to anybody. We don't have to pay any improper, under the cover bribes to anybody, whether it's Iranian or American or Russian or anybody. And he used that as a patriotic approach. We have arrived. We don't have to grovel anymore. We don't have to beg. We don't have to bribe. So he insisted that every single contract that they signed be what he called wire brushed. Checked very carefully. You know, we in our country had what we called at one time the five percenters. And we got some pretty bad publicity among ourselves on that. He insisted that we check every contract to be sure that there were no inappropriate commissions in there. The Iranians initially misunderstood it to mean no commissions. He had to come back with a clarification on it. He says anybody that does a service and earns a commission, that's entirely appropriate. That's all right. And that's when the Kermit Roosevelt thing came to head, because they felt that he was asking for a commission that he had not earned. So they wanted us to check every contract just as carefully as we could. So we have a joint team to do it. I don't know if I told you the Iranians questioned that we were going through a contract one time, and finally one of the Iranian generals saw it, snickered a little bit, and he said, "Well, I see what we're doing. I see we're trying to keep everybody honest and we're trying to keep everything up." Well, bored me. He said, "But our culture is a little different from yours." He says, "You don't quite understand us, but we don't understand you either." And I might have told you this. He says,
"No.
When we start talking about inappropriate payments, improper bribes and commissions and things of that sort," he says, "when I visualize them, I think of your country and to them. Save my life. I can't explain to my 15-year-old son why your football players advertise beef." And he says, "I cannot explain to him why a woman named Suzanne Summers takes off almost all of her clothes, jumps up and down in front of a television screen, and sings, Ace is the place of a helpful hardware man. He said, what does a naked woman have to do with selling hardware? So that's the arena we were in. But as this developed, I found one thing. I found that the Iranians were pretty well ahead of the Americans. The American businessman was much more prone to say, oh heck, it's only a few thousand dollars, pay the guy. They were much more prone to do that than the Iranians were to let it go. Which is sort of heartbreaking to me. It irritated me. But it wasn't unusual at all for an American contract man to say, well, it's trivial. That's not like percentage-wise. It's not like don't waste your time on that.
Interesting. I have a question about, I guess, commercial goals and arms sales. Back in the early 70s, there was a slump in the U.S. aerospace industry. As the Vietnam War was winding down, there was a depression in the aerospace industry. And there's growing concern in Washington about trade deficits. How much did commercial, from your observation at the time, how much did the commercial objectives influence policy towards arms sales to countries like Iran?
I didn't see it. Yeah. From I admit my vantage point was pretty well separate, but I didn't see it at all.
Uh-huh. So there's more strategic reasons for the basic purpose.
Yeah. I do have one little anecdote on it that might give you a little clue, though. Senator Jackson, Scoop Jackson, was
You told me that story last time.
Yeah.
About the Boeing contract?
Yeah.
Right.
So the commercial interests did come in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wasn't in a position to say that that was influential.
In terms of policy making, generally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you were the Congress man, did any of the Rockefeller brothers visit Iran while you were there?
Not that I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in November 72, I've seen a letter that Douglas Heck wrote to Miklos, Jack Miklos, who was a country desk person at the State Department in Washington. Mm-hmm. And in the letter, Heck notes that David Olney had visited Iran recently and made several points in a discussion with Heck. And Olney said that because of the growing volume of arms sales from the U.S. to Iran, that the MAG mission was like no other MAG mission in the world. Got to be treated very differently from the rest. Specifically, he thought that the Amish Mag in Iran should have a new structure and less constraints on it, on its activities, by Congress and by the Joint Chiefs. Now, did Olney talk about this question with you? Finding a new role for the MAG or upgrading its status?
Not in as far as a new role or changing the status. Olney was the one of the top sales people here in Washington. Dave Olney headed the Department of Defense team that went over to negotiate the contract on the helicopters. So I know Dave Olney quite well. I associated with him a good bit, sat in lots of meetings with him, knew him personally. What Doug Heck was saying was that we, at that time, still do to some extent, think of the military advisory and assistance teams, and we don't realize that they change in complexion. Immediately after the war, World War II, those advisory teams were grant aid. They gave stuff away to help people, countries get started. he was saying, Doug was saying, that Iran has outgrown that. Iran gets absolutely no grant aid, none whatsoever. They pay for everything they get.
I should turn this over.